You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology Spotlight Podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Talking Rheumatology Spotlight Podcast. My name is Mariam. I train in the Wessex region, and I'm currently acting up as a consultant in Hampshire Hospitals. Today, we'll be discussing HLH, so hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. And it's a great pleasure to have Dr. Jessica Manson, who's a rheumatology consultant in University College London Hospital and an expert in the topic. Dr. Manson, thank you so much for your time and welcome.
Well, thanks, Mariam, so much for having me and inviting me into ESR, for giving me the opportunity to talk about my favourite subject.
Amazing. So grateful for your time. So we'll start with the basics. And I was thinking of the first basic question, which is, what is HLH?
So, you know, key to everything is that question, isn't it? So HLH is essentially a description of an exaggerated hyperinflammatory response to a stimulus. And in rheumatological practice, we used to call HLH macrophage activation syndrome. And I urge people to move away from that, because we all need to learn from each other. So if hematologists call it HLH and we call it MAS, then we risk not sharing learning, which is terrible and dangerous, because the mortality is still, you know, unacceptably high, about 50% in recent UK data. So it's an exaggerated inflammatory response, a hyperinflammatory response to all number of stimuli. And the patient can look septic on the whole, certainly in full-blown HLH, so with high fevers and being systemically unwell, dropping blood pressure and requiring ITU organ support. So that's how I would define HLH.
Great, thank you. And what are the risk factors and causes for developing HLH? I know they're loads. I was just wondering if you could go through them. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not a pediatrician, I'm an adult physician. But in children, we have to think about primary genetic causes of HLH. And actually, what we're discovering through our practice of adult HLH medicine is that some of these conditions actually do present in adulthood. So we've just diagnosed a 28-year-old woman, and not a child by any measure, in fact, a mother with a primary genetic form of HLH. But in adult practice, we would largely deal with what's called secondary HLH, which means that you have another disease driver. And they can be split broadly into three categories. So the reason that I'm involved in all this is because we as rheumatologists see HLH. And the most common rheumatological cause is adult onset Still's disease, or in children, systemic juvenile idiopathic arthritis. But because Still's is rare, we actually also see numerically a large proportion of these patients in rheumatological practice will have underlying systemic lupus erythematosus, which is a more common condition. And sometimes patients will present with Still's or lupus, and HLH will be their initial presentation, or sometimes it will complicate the disease course. So rheumatological diseases drive HLH, as do other chronic inflammatory diseases like inflammatory bowel disease, for instance, or dermatological diseases. In fact, one of the first cases I ever managed was a patient with pemphigus. Then the second group, and in fact in the UK, the most common driver of HLH in adult medicine is malignancy, in particular hematological malignancy, and most common amongst those drivers are lymphoma, although actually I think more leukemia is complicated by HLH than perhaps hematologists had recognised previously. And this matters hugely, because this is where the worst prognosis lies. And if you don't identify the lymphoma and treat it, the HLH will continue to recur and the patient's chance of survival is very low. And then the third group of drivers are infections. So we've seen that COVID, although in the vast majority COVID induces a different hyperinflammatory syndrome with the COVID pneumonia. But there are patients who develop proper true HLH complicating COVID. And pre-COVID, the most common thing we saw was EBV, and where EBV is endemic, they commonly see EBV-induced HLH, but also other viruses like CMV and, of course, HIV. Tuberculosis can be complicated by HLH, and then so can fungal infections. And essentially any cause of sepsis, viral or bacterial, can lead to HLH in a percentage of those patients. And we think that patients who have a sort of hyper-inflammatory phenotype of sepsis are at particularly high risk of dying from their sepsis. So those are the sort of three sets of conditions that we consider. And then there are things that we do to patients. So there are drugs that can cause HLH. So we've recently seen two cases of lamotrigine-induced HLH. And then there are interventions like bone marrow transplant and CAR T-cell treatment that can also cause it. So the reason why this is all of our business is because it affects pretty much every medical specialty. And when the patient presents at the front door, you commonly can't tell which of these drivers is making the patient look so unwell. And I used to think, you know, I could make diagnoses of Still's disease or of lymphoma, you know, from taking a good clinical history, but actually you just can't. And you have to investigate each patient, you know, starting with the worst possibility that they have a hematological malignancy and working backwards, which means, you know, thorough investigation of every patient. And whenever you make an assumption, ah, this patient has a rash, therefore it's more likely to be Still's, you can come a cropper. So be very careful about that.
Thank you. That's really helpful. So when should we suspect HLH, and what investigations are required? I know we use the H-score. How useful do you think H-score is?
So just to start with the last question. So we have several sets of diagnostic criteria and classification criteria that can be useful. And I think in common practice, I must say, I think the H-score is the most useful, which can be accessed. You know, you just do an internet search for the H-score and you get a very easy to use calculator, which has several easy to request tests. So, for instance, it includes AST and ferritin and triglyceride levels and analysis of cytopenia. It also asks for some imaging, cross-sectional imaging for the level of the patient's fever, whether they're known to have immunosuppression beforehand. And then if you have it, whether the patient has a hemophagocytosis on a bone marrow. And so it's a very useful tool. The end of the H-score is it gives you a number and then a percentage probability of this being HLH. And it has shown to be a reliable marker for HLH in all sorts of inpatient settings, including in critical care, which is very useful. The key thing is, though, to sort of trust your judgment. So if a patient comes up with a sort of moderate possibility of HLH on the score and you're not certain, then please repeat all the markers and do the same thing tomorrow. And if the patient has become more unwell and the H-score is now convincing, you know, it's not a binary thing, it's a spectrum. So we do quite often repeat the H-score. So that's the H-score. I would suspect HLH in a patient who is unwell with the three Fs, so fever, falling blood counts, and a rising ferritin. So the only thing that you wouldn't naturally always do in every general medical patient who is unwell with a fever is request a ferritin. And in our practice, we've really changed that now. Every unwell patient, we add a ferritin to the blood test if they have a fever. And, you know, you get used to seeing unwell patients, and sometimes you just get the feeling that there's something extra going on. And that is a really important hunch to trust and to follow. And I've very much noticed that our intensive care colleagues, for instance, are becoming much more aware of HLH and much more saying, do you know, this patient just isn't quite behaving in the typical way of having sepsis. So let's screen this patient for HLH too. So there are other diagnostic and classification criteria. So in children with systemic JIA, there are set criteria. And then hematological practice has used this HLH 2004 criteria, which in my view can be unhelpful because it includes measurements that are not easy to get currently on the NHS, such as soluble CD25. So this test, for instance, for us is requested at Greater Ormond Street and can take a couple of weeks to turn around. And clearly that is not helpful when you have an acutely unwell patient in front of you. So in terms of investigations, we have a really useful summary document that's available through the National HLH Group, HIHASC, through the website. But in essence, what you're doing is screening the patient, both number one, to see whether they have HLH, and number two, to see if you can identify the driver. So the way that we've suggested you approach the patient is you say, okay, this patient has a fever and is unwell and is deteriorating and not getting better in the way that we would expect them to. We notice that their blood counts are falling, and often the first thing that happens is the platelet count and then subsequently other cytopenias. We'll add a ferritin. So if the ferritin is completely normal, then it's very unlikely to be HLH. If the ferritin is elevated beyond 1,000 or so, then you certainly need to be thinking about it. And what we quite often see, in fact, we just managed a patient like this on the ward, is a patient who suddenly flips into HLH. So one day had a ferritin of 800 and the next day had a ferritin of 9,000. So repeated measures are important. So, and then you require, you know, organ function assessment. So you want to check their bone marrow function, you want to check liver function, renal function, you want to check for any cardiac involvement. So we've seen sudden deaths from cardiac involvement. You need cross-sectional imaging to see whether you can identify the driver in part. And then you want to start going through each set of investigations. So do we think this is an infection? You need to send off a full viral screen and bacterial blood cultures and biopsy anything and culture for TB. Do we think this is a malignancy? Biopsy anything abnormal, have a very low threshold to biopsy. And if you still think the patient has a lymphoma, start thinking of some unusual biopsies. So we do something called deep skin biopsy, where we found intravascular lymphoma on patients who actually have normal PET scans, which is important to think about. And do we think this patient actually, in spite of being an adult, has a primary genetic form of HLH, in which case we need to be sending off functional tests to wherever your lab is. Again, for us, it's Great Ormond Street, but it depends a bit where you are in the country. And then for rheumatologists, you know, take a really good rheumatological history. As I said, don't be tricked too easily by an assumption that it's Still's disease because of the triad of fever, rash and arthritis, but obviously that would help us think about Still's. And you want to send off a full autoimmune screen, and we're good at recognising clinical patterns of vasculitis or dermatomyositis or lupus that can all be complicated by HLH. So there is a lot of testing, I'm afraid, Mariam, a lot of testing.
Thank you. That is really, really helpful summary of the investigations. Thank you. So coming to treatment, so what are the treatment considerations, and is there a set guideline that we could follow or refer to?
Yes. So the answer to that question is no. There are some guidelines being developed. I run the national group HIHASC, the Hyperinflammation and HLH Cross-Specialty Collaboration, which I run with my colleague, Dr. Rachel Tattersall, who's a pediatric adolescent adult rheumatologist in Sheffield. And she has introduced a treatment guideline into her trust, which has now been adopted in several other units. As you know, the evidence base for the management of HLH is tricky, which makes an evidence-based guideline in some ways tricky. But there are some things that we do know. So if you think a patient has HLH, what you're really saying is that you feel that the risk of immunosuppressing this unwell patient is worth taking for the potential benefit. And I think if you've got as far as saying, right, this patient has a high H score, you know, they are very unwell, then you have to plough on with treatment, which can require confidence and support. And I'm very pleased that I work within a multidisciplinary group of doctors at UCLH, which helps bolden me to make those decisions. But the first line treatment will almost always be steroids. And as rheumatologists, we're so comfortable with methylprednisolone that that's where I tend to go first. So between 500 and a gram pulse on 3 consecutive days, and then equivalent 1 milligram per kilogram prednisolone thereafter. We often use IV methylprednisolone because the patients are so unwell they can't absorb, but I titrate it using that 1 milligram per kilogram of pred equivalent. We now have permission from NHS England, so within England, and I understand that they are similar sorts of arrangements possible in the devolved nations, but within England there's a document from NHS England which permits and funds the use of anakinra for HLH all comers, so not just rheumatological causes. And we use anakinra very unusually, not in the way that's described in the product characteristic in the SPC. So we use anakinra intravenously, and when it's used intravenously, it has a short half-life, so you need to give it either twice or three times a day, and we use it up to a total of 8 milligrams per kilogram. And what we have learnt over doing this for several years is that when a patient is unwell with HLH, you should go in hard early. So we tend to start with a gram of methylprednisolone and 4 milligrams per kilogram of anakinra in divided doses, and then titrate downwards if they respond and upwards if they don't. So that would be my first line treatment. So I tend to use both of these drugs, if not together, then certainly in quick succession. If you think a patient very likely has a lymphoma and the patient is stable enough, then there is an argument to try and use anakinra for the first day or so while you biopsy an abnormal lymph node or abnormal looking liver or so forth, because we know that many lymphomas are sensitive to steroid. And if you fill the patient with steroid, you may end up masking the lymphoma, which then complicates the longer term management. But in practice, if you have a patient who's very unwell in front of you, then you can't practice perfect neat medicine. You need to keep the patient alive, and you have to accept that you may have to get them through this episode of HLH, then pull back on the steroid treatment and then re-biopsy. So first line steroids with anakinra, occasionally anakinra on its own for that very unusual circumstance that I describe. And then there are three other drugs that we use not infrequently. So the first is intravenous immunoglobulin, and the standard dosing is a gram per kilogram on 2 consecutive days. This is again funded, but you do need to apply to your IVIG panel. And that can be repeated a fortnight later. So I would tend to go to that next if the patient is not stabilizing. And obviously the nice thing about IVIG is we know that it's not unsafe in throes of infection. Then the next drug we use is cyclosporin. Before anakinra, we used a lot of cyclosporin. And in fact, we've seen lots of patients turn around by using intravenous cyclosporin at a dose of 1 milligram per kilogram BD. Higher doses, we have some concern about toxicity, and long-term use of cyclosporin, we certainly have concerns about toxicity, but in the short time, it can be very useful. And some patients, even since we've used anakinra, I've used cyclosporin when they keep flaring despite anakinra and steroids. So some patients, you pull back the steroids and the HLH comes back again. And cyclosporin is a nice kind of stabilizer. So we as rheumatologists introduced anakinra to our hematology colleagues, and they have really reassured me and educated me on the efficacy and the usefulness of etoposide in some patients with HLH, even in a rheumatologically driven HLH. If a patient is incredibly unwell, then 1 or 2 doses of etoposide can be enough to turn the whole process off. And I think we've been emboldened to use each other's drugs by working across specialties in this way. So whatever you're doing to these patients, you are profoundly immunosuppressing them. And the HLH itself, although representing a huge activation of the immune system, is also causing all kinds of inefficiencies such that the patient is at high risk of infection. So alongside all these immunosuppressive drugs, we now, as standard, use antimicrobial prophylaxis. And we have a protocol which is accessible on our website. If you search for the UCLH HLH service, we've made it free for everyone to have a look at, but it's pretty standard antimicrobial prophylaxis against fungus, virus, and PCP. So I would advocate using that in parallel.
Thank you. That's very clear. I know you've mentioned the causes for developing HLH, but I was wondering if you could please summarize the rheumatological triggers and how we should screen for them.
Yeah, so in rheumatological practice, we have the least bad outcome. Depending on where you look, mortality is more like 10% than sometimes in hematological malignancy, closer to 70%. And that's partly because, of course, on the whole, our disease has a much lower mortality. And also because we often have a bit of a lead time. So, for instance, one of our clinical nurse specialists recently caught, as it were, a patient who had HLH. We were monitoring them as an outpatient. They were known to have adult onset Still's disease, and their liver function tests were becoming abnormal. And at the same time, we were monitoring CRP and ESR. And what she noticed was a dichotomy that the CRP was going up and the ESR is falling. And in chronic disease management, that is a really useful sign that the patient is developing HLH or MAS, as we used to call it. So if you're monitoring a patient and they're not well, and they have either lupus or Still's in particular, and they have persistent fever, and the ESR starts to drop, or the platelets, which were kind of appropriately high normal start to fall into the lower normal or just mildly thrombocytopenic range, then I would have a very, very low threshold for having a really good look at them and checking a ferritin. And I suspect that means that they're developing HLH. And of course, the beauty is that if you can get in there quickly, you can probably switch it off, even sometimes with oral steroids, if you're prompt with your treatment. As I said at the beginning, sometimes patients present catastrophically with their first presentation of Still's disease or their first presentation of lupus being with HLH. And then you have to aggressively manage both of those things. And then, of course, we're good at then the long-term management of their lupus or their Still's. And they often live in terrible fear of it happening again. And we help to manage that, both the fear and the risk, by controlling their chronic disease, you know, as best we can. The other thing I would say is that sometimes patients who have apparently had stable disease, say lupus, for a long time, will present with HLH, and then you need to ask yourself, is this really the lupus or is there something else going on? So we've had patients, for instance, who present then with a CMV infection or a herpes virus causing HLH on the background of their already abnormal immune system, partly because they have lupus, partly because they're on, say, azathioprine or something. So always ask yourself the question, is there something else going on? And then we've also seen patients with chronic rheumatological disease who then actually HLH is the beginning of their lymphoma presentation. So never stop thinking, never make assumptions. But we do have the beauty of being able to, on the whole, control our chronic diseases in a way that reduces the risk of A, the patient dying, and B, them presenting again with HLH.
Thank you. That's great. So I was going to touch upon the role of MDT, so locally and nationally. What would you suggest is the role of MDT on local level? And then when should we consider referring to the national HLH MDT in London?
So having an MDT, a multidisciplinary group of consultants and trainees that includes haematology, infectious diseases, virology, critical care, rheumatology, neurology, acute medicine, at UCLH has completely transformed our practice. I mean, completely transformed it. We are now picking HLH up in places where I'm sure we would have missed it beforehand. We are now confident in our management approach. We are all bringing different bits of experience and information into the group. We're now really busy. So we used to see about 4 patients a year about 10 years ago, and we managed 30 patients or so in-house in the last year. And these are not straightforward admissions. We have a huge lymphoma cohort at UCLH and leukemia cohort. And so they are really very unwell patients. We're now so busy that we have the UCLH inpatient MDT meets every week. And then as you suggested, we also host twice a month an external meeting where we've helped in the management of about 100 patients in the last year and a half or so. And these are referred from across the UK. The meetings are held on Teams. And basically, we encourage anybody who doesn't feel confident in the way that they're managing the patient, needs some support and advice, to refer patients. We very commonly also offer urgent MDTs because these patients don't wait till a Wednesday evening twice a month. So my team are extremely good tempered about the endless 4:30 on a Friday urgent MDT call. So really a low threshold to refer. My colleague Rachel Tadsall in Sheffield has a similar arrangement across from sort of the idea eventually will be to have a kind of northern and a southern hub. But basically, we're all pretty responsive to email and we're very, very keen to help. Again, our email address is available on the UCLH HLH website. So through that, we've begun to develop a kind of hub and spoke model, which is, I think, the way this sort of medicine should be done. So, for instance, my colleague Matt Zito, who's a rheumatologist, and Denise Delord in Kent have now set up a network across Kent to try and help manage these patients and to ensure that anakinra is provided and safely monitored and so forth. Another colleague, Sarah Levy in Croydon, has set up a local MDT within a DGH with associated guidelines in-house. So this is really possible, but it absolutely requires a team of people around you and enthusiasm and hard work and a willingness to sort of drop everything else and quickly help out with these patients. But it's, you know, incredibly rewarding, interesting medicine to do. And in the way that we have practiced at UCLH, and actually almost identically mirrored by Rachel's data in Sheffield, the establishment of an HLH MDT at UCLH has resulted in is associated with, not cause and effect, but associated with the halving of our mortality from HLH at UCLH. So it's it's work worth doing, I think.
Amazing. It's great to have a national center. Thank you so much for this. So one more question. Any updates on research work on HLH?
Yeah, so the first answer to that is there's so much to do. You know, there's so much morbidity and mortality. And HIHAS, the national group, have really dedicated ourselves to trying to reduce the mortality and to improve service provision and to improve education about HLH across the UK and beyond. So we've just been awarded an MRC grant, which is great. So the MRC has decided to award grants really focusing on rare disease, because rare disease research is so difficult because of the rarity. And we've now started a biobank at UCLH with a matched registry, which we are now rolling out across the UK. So again, really keen if anyone wants to be involved as a recruiting site. And there are lots of interesting and parallel projects alongside that. So a colleague in Nottingham, Fiona Pearce, who's an epidemiologist, is working, looking at the epidemiology of HLH. We're doing some genetics to try and understand why, you know, the vast majority of people who get a lymphoma don't get HLH, but some do, or the vast majority of patients with lupus don't get HLH, but some do. We're doing some work looking at the role of viruses, and also trying to find novel ways of diagnosing lymphoma more quickly, obviously that being led by the haematologist. So there's masses of research coming. And yeah, anyone who's keen to get involved, please shout.
Great. Thank you. Right. I know you see lots of HLH patients. Any final tips to share? Any suggestions for the rheumatologists?
So I think the first thing to say is rheumatologists are really good at this kind of medicine. We are good at uncertainty. We are good at complexity. We are good at looking after patients who don't fit in neat boxes. So I feel rheumatologists really can play such a critical role in looking after these patients, who often other doctors say, oh, well, you know, they don't clearly have a hematological problem or clearly have an infection problem, so we don't know how to sort of lead the management. And I think as rheumatologists, we should be bold and confident about what we can offer in the management of these complex patients with poorly understood diagnoses. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to trust your hunch. You know, we look after so much complex chronic condition. And when a patient isn't behaving in quite the way you expect them to, and they have a fever, then just start asking yourself the question every time, if you're not already, does this patient have a sort of hyperinflammatory HLH-like response? The third thing is to talk to your colleagues in your hospital and start thinking about what kind of networking you can set up around where you are. BSR has just given us a special interest group, which is great. So we're going to we're pitching for a session for BSR next year, the inaugural hyperinflammation special interest group. And we're going to talk, if we do get a session, about how to do exactly those sorts of things. And please just shout to us if we can help you through HIHAS or through the UCLH MDT. Lots of people come to our meetings, actually. Once they've presented once, they keep coming back to try and learn about these complex patients. And, you know, I've seen lots of people now who've been unwell with HLH, and I feel like I know I learn from every single one, and it's very, very rewarding medicine. So I'd encourage people to get involved.
Thank you so much. Thank you for taking out time, Dr. Manson. Really, really grateful and really helpful suggestions. And thank you to everyone listening. Please don't forget to check out other resources on the websites. That includes our e-learning case, webinars, and the journal articles for HLH. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology Spotlight, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share, and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.